is get a little bit of an introduction to the first sugi in Bava Metzia, and really a little bit of introduction to the Masechta as a whole. It really is it's a tremendous thrill to be able to learn Bava Metzia with you this year. I remember I made a similar comment last year, but I'll do it again. I think I saw a story once, Baruch Rabibowitz was in the middle of shir, and he said, he's like, Yishmaka Rashba, and he stopped himself in the middle, he said, this is Elul, I have to do tshuva, all of Torah is beautiful, I don't want to single out, I don't want to take the wine, I have to be Makapa for that. So, with apologies for that quote, there is a special joy to learn Bava Metzia, even though it is Elul. There is a special privilege, maybe Davka, because of Elul. Of course, all of Torah is beautiful, but especially when it comes to, first of all, Nezikin. So I know the Gemara has in Bava Kama a couple of ways in which a person can be achasid. Haman the boy, the Mehdi Chasid, a person who wants to really refine himself, a person who wants to really perfect his qualities. So the Gemara has a couple of possibilities. It should be Mekayim, Milei the Avos is one of them. The other two possibilities, Milei the Brachos and Milei the Nezikin. So if anybody here, I don't know if anybody got inspired to pick up Daf Yomi and to see him, so anybody who's learning both Daf Yomi and Bava Metzia and Shir, so you have at least two out of three bases covered. So that's a pretty good start for Elul if you want to really work on your piety, you want to really become a chassid, so to speak. So to be involved in both Milei the Brachos and Milei the Nezikin at the same time is a special privilege. Beyond that, I think it's fair to say, again, with all due deference to the rest of the Torah, so there is a special quality to the involvement in topics of Nezikin, in topics of Kosher Mishpat, in topics of Benodim L'Chaveiro. There is a story that's recounted, the Sefer Erech HaChaim is a Sefer Hilchos Kas. You should know the entire Sefer devoted to the laws of Kas. So in the Hakdama to that Sefer, there is a story that is recounted that the Chafetz Chaim, as we know, the Chafetz Chaim wrote many, many Sfarim. And he's most famous for the one he was named after, but he wrote many other Sfarim as well. And the Chafetz Chaim was once approached by a businessman who wanted to buy all of his Sfarim, with one exception. He didn't want to buy the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. So Chafetz Chaim is happy to sell all his Sfarim, he's a little offended. This is the one he got named after. So he asked the man, he says, if you can tell me, why is it that you're interested in every other Sefer and not the Chafetz Chaim? So the man told him, you know, you wrote the Mishnah Berurah, the laws of tefillah, the laws of day-to-day life. I think I can handle that. You wrote a Sefer about Karbanos. I don't think that's going to cause me any problems. You wrote a Sefer about how to talk about each other, about how not to talk badly about people. I don't think I could handle that. I'm out there in a dog-eat-dog world. I don't think I'd be able to observe any of these halachas, so I'm not interested in buying a Sefer. The Chafetz Chaim didn't accept that excuse, and so shockingly. And he quoted that Yisrael Salanter had said about his Sefer. The Chafetz Chaim said that this Sefer is so worthwhile that it would be worth it even if all you accomplish with the Sefer is that one Jew should read it and... What's next? You think one Jew would read it and change his behavior? But what he said was, even if one Jew would read it and sigh, meaning he'd say, oh, if only I could keep these halachos, well, I can't move on with you. That would be enough. That would be worthwhile. That's a surprising statement, because that's not halachically how we normally assume. And the Gemara says in Sefer Bates and elsewhere that if you don't think somebody is going to keep the halachos that you're telling them, better they should know about it. The principle of mutav shirshogin v'alyu v'zidin, that is preferable for a person if he's not going to keep halacha one way or another, it's better he doesn't even know about it in the first place. So to say, as the Chafetz Chaim is saying here, that it's better to be aware of the halachos even if you're not going to fulfill them, it's not so obvious why that's the case. It doesn't seem to really fit the halacha. So I think what he was getting at is based on a comment of the Rambam. The Rambam in his Hakdama to Pirkei Avos, so he will fill Milei the Avos as well today. The Rambam in his Hakdama to Pirkei Avos says, and if you're probably familiar with a well-known Medrash, the Yalkut Shemoni quotes, that there's no mitzvah for a person to say, trade food, that doesn't appeal to me at all. And he goes past McDonald's and he sees the sign, two burgers, fries, a Coke, and a free apartment, 98 cents. There's no mitzvah for him to say that's not appealing whatsoever. It's fine if you admit that that's a very attractive offer. But what can you do? Zeirus HaMelech, I'm not allowed. You don't have to pretend that it's not interesting. Says the Rambam, maybe Bakavendin disagreed, there's a whole story at the bottom of the page, there's a Hasagas from Bakavendin, but the Rambam asserts that that is only true by what we might call the chukim, by the mitzvos that we don't really understand, the mitzvos that are beyond our rationality. So in that context, the Medrash is telling us that it's fine to say, I have a Yetzirah for this, I want to do this, but Zeirus HaMelech, Kadosh Baruch Hu told me not. But when it comes to the mitzvos that we can understand a little bit, we never fully grasp everything, but when it comes to the mitzvos that are a little bit more accessible to our thought processes, so then, that's a different story, says the Rambam. We're looking to create personalities that are effective, that are defined by these ideas. And it is indeed the goal that we will find ourselves in sync with these ideas. So even if we start off with a desire to steal and to hurt people and to do whatever it is, ultimately the goal is that by studying these principles, it should have an impact on our personality. We should create a different mentality through this type of study. And therefore, this whole area of the Ben Adam L'Chavero, the Choshen Mishpat realm, is one where there's a whole additional level to the Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah is applicable to everything, but this realm is a particular milah that is unique to this area. And therefore, perhaps, as the Chofetz Chaim was saying, that yes, it's true in Hilchos Shabbos, let's say, if somebody's not going to observe the halacha, it's okay. Mutav shushol b'yavali b'zid, better they shouldn't know about it. But when it comes to Hilchos Lashon Hara, when it comes to Bava Metzia, even if you're not going to be able to observe every rule, the more you experience it, the more you learn it, the greater impact that has on your personality, and that itself is an accomplishment. And particularly in Elul, when we're looking to get closer to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, the whole act of tshuva is about coming closer and bridging that gap. So Choshen Mishpat, and as we'll see in a few minutes, particularly Bava Metzia, gives us a unique opportunity to access, so to speak, as much as we can, Chachmas HaBoreh, and to transform our personalities in even more direct ways. So particularly for Elul and all year round, it's really a very special opportunity. To throw in one more Milei Davos for a complete set, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbeinu Yonah, on the Mishnah, in Pirkei Avos, the first Mishnah, which tells us, Hevi Mesunim B'din, that we normally translate, we should be careful and deliberate in matters of judgment. Again, that's also kind of a meta theme for this Masechta specifically. But Rabbeinu Yonah added, it also means, or others have added, says it somewhere at least, that if we want to understand the Kadosh Baruch Hu's Chachma, there's a particular opportunity to do so if we are Mesunim B'din, if we ponder matters of din, if we ponder matters of justice, we have even greater access, even greater possibilities, or different kinds of possibilities, in terms of developing our God-infused personalities, our personalities that are directed and that are inspired by Chachmas HaBoreh. So there is a particular thrill to be able to learn Choshen Mishpat as a whole, especially in Elul and all year round. But also, if we focus specifically out of all of Nezikin on Bava Metzia, and if we focus within Bava Metzia on the first parak, as is our agenda for today, so we have an even more directed opportunity in this area. To try to give some type of a general introduction to Bava Metzia seems a little bit difficult because other mesechtas lend themselves more to picking one topic to address as a psicha.
If you want to talk about Yevamos, you want to talk about Shabbos, you want to talk about Gittin, Kiddushin, so it's easier to have an introductory shir, a shir psicha that addresses the topic, the central theme of the session. If you want to learn about Metzia, it seems on the surface a little bit harder, because it's not even clear what it is as a Masechta. Right, the whole name is itself essentially chapter 2. It doesn't really have a theme on the surface. And the Gemara in Bava Kamma suggests that all of Nezikin on some level is considered to be one Masechta. And that's how we get funny names like First Gate, Second Gate, Third Gate, Bava Kamma, Metzia, and Bava Basra. This is a machlokus in the Rishonim, whether we mean all of Nezikin, like we call Nezikin, Seder Nezikin, or just these three Masechtas that have these joined names. But any way you look at it, it seems that Bava Metzia is really a part of a larger whole, and it's harder to pinpoint a theme. There are some suggestions made in the Sefer Stei Sofim, in his Hakdama, so he notes that there is kind of a grouping that if you learn Bava Kamma, so Bava Kamma is about things that happen be'isser, it's about monetary issues that happen because of some type of an avera or an offense, issues of gneva and gezela, issues of mazik, of damaging somebody's property. While Bava Metzia shifts the focus to monetary issues that arise from heter, but not necessarily from offenses that have been committed, at least necessarily, we'll see if that's always the case. But essentially the question of figuring out how we share property, how we decide if there's a conflict in property, if there are issues between people in terms of mamonos that don't necessarily arise from any type of crime, any type of offense. So Bava Metzia is focused on that. Within that realm, to try to understand how we end up starting the way we do, so the Rishonim, they didn't even put this on the list because it would have been a little bit of a distraction, but if you look at the Rishonim right away, in the beginning of the Masechta, they try to figure out a few things. They try to figure out how exactly Bava Metzia fits into the whole set of three, and some of them try to figure out within Bava Metzia why it is that it starts the way it does. So some Rishonim, for example, raise the question that our first Mishnah is premised upon the notion that if you find something, there are times when you can keep it. And our first Mishnah is talking about two people who are fighting over who owns a garment that at least one of the scenarios in the Mishnah is they both claim to have found it. So some of the Rishonim ask, a lot of the Rishonim ask, isn't this Masechta out of order? Because, as we mentioned, maybe on Sundays we'll learn about the laws of lost property and found property. So shouldn't we figure that out first? Shouldn't we have the second paragraph, Bava Metzia, which tells us that there are times when we have to return something and times when we don't? So then we know that there is such a thing. You could find something and sometimes you can keep it. So for this paragraph to all of a sudden start talking within that context, so some of the Rishonim said the whole Masechta seems out of order, right? There has to be some kind of explanation why we wouldn't have the second parak first to first establish that if you find some lost property, sometimes you're allowed to keep it. It's a question some of the Rishonim were bothered by, and they had various answers. But some of the Rishonim apparently weren't bothered by it. And hopefully today or tomorrow we'll have a little bit of a suggestion why we might think that maybe this really is the ideal way to start. You could tell that some of the Rishonim weren't bothered by it because, for example, Tosus, the first Tosus over here, Tosus raises the question why it is that this parak is here under the assumption that we treat Nezikin as one big Masechta. So it says if it's all one big Masechta, so then we have to worry, the Prakim have to have an order. Implying that we're only worried about how does this flow from Bava Kamma. But Bava Metzia itself, this volume, everyone agrees is one Masechta. So apparently Tosfos isn't worried about why is the second parak after the first parak. Because that you could ask even without saying all of Nezikin is one Masechta. So some Rishonim were bothered by this and some weren't. And ultimately, after we finish getting a little bit of a taste of what's going on, maybe we'll have some suggestion as to why that is. So what does our Mishnah first start off by telling us? What topic is it that the Mishnah establishes as the theme, which really, as we'll see, could be a central theme, perhaps for all of Nezikin, and for all of Choshen Mishpat? What's the issue our Mishnah is talking about? Mishnah was really conveying, let's say, at least two or three dinim. What dinim do we see in the Mishnah? Anyone? Yeah, Zach?
You swear when you caught half of it.
Okay, so the swearing is an interesting point. I would say that's the second detail, and that will separate out. So the swearing is a very interesting issue. Why is the shvuah here? The Gemara is ultimately going to tell us the shvuah is actually a very secondary component. But we'll get to that eventually. So that's, I think, the at least the second or third din in the Mishnah. What's the first din in the Mishnah?
First din in the Mishnah, I think, is that if you find some, that if you have a problem with something, this is something, you split it. And then it starts talking about being kind of...
Okay. So the first din in the Mishnah, which we'll see, is not really the whole story. But if all we knew was this Mishnah, and we didn't know anything else, so then we have a din, which I think is what you said, that... if you have a suffix about money, so essentially you split it. So this could be phrased, which as the Gemara eventually tells us in a few places, is a statement attributed particularly to Sumchus, right? The Mamon Hamutal B'Safek Yachloku. Now it doesn't necessarily mean Sumchus is alone in this. There's something unique about Sumchus' position, we'll have to eventually get to that. But taken by itself, the Mishnah could be saying, all right, you have the suffix and money, two people are fighting over something, some property. What's the rule? We split it. And of course, why is it not so simple? How do we discover quickly enough that we can't really summarize the Mishnah that way? Because...
The next place doesn't split it 50-50.
The next case of Mishnah?
Yeah.
Well, because the Mishnah then talks about a different kind of suffix, but their suffix is not different.
Yeah, right.
Right, so the numbers are different. But even beyond that, hey?
The Shavuot.
The Shavuot, right. So the Shavuot is also part of it. Again, right, the Shavuot really tries to, we'll try to deal with this separately.
Yeah? We're going to have Machlokas Chachamim and Rabbana within that focus
now. Okay, so some, in general, there is Machlokas in terms of Sumchus and Chachamim, it sounds like. But also...
How do you define a suffix?
Oh, how do you define a suffix? That's going to be a great question. That's going to be very important. It's actually answering a later question, but that's something for sure we're going to have to try to figure out. How do we define a suffix? But the issue that we'll see in the Gemara, and that certainly the Rishonim you'll get a chance to see a little bit tomorrow we're going to bring up, is that there are tons of other cases where that doesn't seem to be the policy. So we have to figure out a little bit why that is. Now, why is it sometimes the policy is the afloku? And the shu is an important detail that we'll put it aside for a moment. So why is it sometimes the policy is yachloku, and sometimes it's not? So just to give a little bit of an overview for what's going to take us really a few days, once we get past the introduction today or tomorrow, it's going to take us a few days to examine all these details. But we'll really find that each detail gives us a very powerful insight into what's going on. That why there are a number of models, probably about six, depending on how you count, probably about six different approaches that are taken, say between three and six, depending on which ones you want to count, at least three, to issues of doubt. So the Gemara and the Rishonim, and certainly the Sugya, some of you I know saw a little bit of Bava Basra, because I know he was providing Bava Basra to people. So if you see the Sugya in Bava Basra and you see the Sugya in Bava Metzia, so the Gemara already asks a few questions about how there are other cases which don't have the same rule. And certainly the Rishonim, and hopefully you'll get to see a fuller range of it tomorrow, certainly the Rishonim expose us to other cases where this is not the policy, where we don't say Yachlok. So we have to figure out a few things together. We have to figure out, first of all, so what are the various policies? Then we got to figure out why is it that we invoke one and not the other in the given case? What are the rules? What are the criteria that push us in one direction or the other? Why do those criteria impact anything? What difference do they make? And then we'll see that there are many machlokisim within machlokisim. So
we'll have to look at each one carefully, but hopefully together, this sugya, which really essentially is about one of the key aspects of Chosha Mishpat, how do we address conflict? Right? Really, all of civil law is about conflict between parties. So this is really the ABC. This is really step one. What types of ideas are invoked in terms of addressing conflict? So hopefully through the course of looking at some of the ins and outs of the sugya, we'll get a lot of exposure to some of the chachma that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is conveying through the sugya. And that's self part of the point, by the way. But one of the questions that let's think about as we talk about some of these ideas is, where do these ideas come from? And what are the makoros for these din? Are they psukim? Was the Gemara quoting a pasuk to tell us these din? And in most cases, doesn't seem to be the case. A little bit, yes, but for the most part, these cases, these scenarios the Gemara gives us, it's not clear where they come from. So if they don't come from any pasuk, so what are we left with? Well, brises that are really conveying to us the dinim, right? But where is the mishnayos and conveying to us the dinim? But where are they ultimately coming from? They're not interpreting psukim. So these are ultimately svaras. Right? These are ultimately notions that Chazal felt to be logical. And as we see, they weren't always in agreement as to what was the most logical approach. So that itself gives us a lot to examine and try to understand about how this process is meant to work. And in fact, you could ask yourself the question as we learn some of these sugyas. So, all right, so we know this is telling us how a Beis Din should address a certain question. So what would you do if you weren't Jewish, let's say? Let's say you were a non-Jewish court, right? Which we know the halacha not only recognizes, right, but the halacha requires. Right? This is the one positive mitzvah that applies to all of humanity. We have seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, and so seven mitzvahs that apply to everyone. Six of them are Yisurim, and prohibitions, and we have one positive mitzvah. And that mitzvah is the mitzvah of Din. It happens to be Machlokas, Rambam, and Ramban. We'll go into it in so much detail about what that mitzvah means. But suffice it to say for now that certainly the Gemara, the Torah, recognizes a obligation among non-Jews as well to judge the conflicts that they have amongst themselves. So should we assume that these dinim are unique to Jews? Or maybe these are dinim that would be observed by a non-Jewish court as well? But if our point is, if ultimately the driving force behind these dinim is that they seem to make the most sense, so then it would follow that the halacha would expect, presumably, a non-Jewish court to follow similar ideas as well. So that machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, I mentioned, you can look it up, I didn't put it on the list, but the Ramban, in his commentary to Parshas Vayishlach, the episode of Shimon and Levi executing the people of Shechem, so the Ramban over there comments against the Rambam. The Ramban understands that actually non-Jews as well are obligated to observe Chosha Mishpat. Essentially the same dinim that we have, that's universal. The civil code, the Chosha Mishpat section of Shulchan Aruch, that applies to the whole world equally. So if you say that, well then for sure, okay, then fine, Rav Metzia would seem to apply to a non-Jewish court as well. But even if you don't go so far, even if you say that, no, they don't have to follow our halachas, they have to follow what makes sense. They have to follow whatever rules they set up to regulate their society. So still, if this is all essentially what is driving these dinim for the most part, so then one could argue this is not simply addressed to Jewish society, but all of society maybe would want to function along these principles. And again, they're going to be disputed, so it's a question of how you're going to land, but the logic driving them is going to be relevant perhaps to everyone. So we have to try to figure out what are the different cases, what pushes us to say one way or another in a given case, what are the elements
that are part of the equation? And how does all of that fit in to any type of a coherent perspective as far as what it is we're trying to accomplish? So can anyone help me out? What are some other cases the Gemara has or some other policies? Other than Yachloka, what else do we have? Hi.
Kol Dalim Dvar.
So that's the first one that's brought up as a contradiction to this policy. Especially if you see Tosus over here. Tosus on Daf Beis and Bav Metzia. And also Tosus on Daf Lamed Dalet of Beis in Bava Basra, where the Gemara talks over there about Kol Dalim Gavar. So both cases, the Gemara, the Tosus, Rishonim want to know why there are two different policies. Now, part of what makes things complex and everything is intertwined with each other is what exactly does Kol Dalim Gavar mean? So we're not 100% sure. We'll say right away that it's a major debate among the Rishonim, and that's something that we'll have to give more focus to in the coming days. But just to be able to get from one sentence to the next, can anyone help me out a little bit? What does that phrase mean, Kol Dalim Gavar? Jonathan?
It's like whoever's stronger wins.
So literally translate to might makes right, right? Which does not seem like such a refined principle on the surface. So it happens to be that there is a major debate among the Rishonim, very major debate as to what that means. Now, what are some possibilities? Yes? Yes, so now you're going into an interpretation stage, right? But you're right, and we'll have to get to that. We'll get into more detail, but just... You're saying, does it mean that Beis Din walks away, or that this is somehow a clarification process within the context of Din? But that is secondary to the question of just what's happened. Right? So what does Kol Dalim Gavar mean?
A distinction between whether it's a stronger claim or just physical fight.
Right, so it could be either. Right, so we've shown in quote both, and those do seem very much to be on very different ends of the spectrum. Right, so it could mean that you really literally duke it out, so to speak, whoever is actually stronger wins. Or maybe it's within the process of Beis Din, whoever is able to make a stronger case is going to win. So that's obviously going to make a big difference. We're going to have to figure out which one it is. We're going to have to figure out, in terms of preferences, why one seems to be invoked over the other. But Kol Dalim Gavar is one policy, which is clearly very different than Yachlok. So we'll have to also figure out why it is we would choose one or the other, which, of course, is also contingent to some degree as to what the phrase means. So everything is a little bit of a complex structure, but we'll try to see how much we can identify one piece at a time. What other policies does the Gemara mention? Okay, who's up first? Okay, we'll call Dolan Gemara, yeah?
Next one we discussed is Eimunah.
Okay, Eimunah, right? So what does that mean, essentially?
Now we don't know what to do, so we're just going to not judge until like, we're able to find out.
Right, so basically this is kind of a, sounds like a little bit of a penalty depending on how it plays out. Right, it's also my focus in the Gemara, what Yehemunach means. Because the case the Gemara has is the case of Mana Shlishi. Right, what is Mana Shlishi?
Two people are deposited by someone, and the person is not responsible for knowing which one deposited 100 or one coin and which one deposited two. Mm-hmm. And then they're both claiming that they gave the right one.
Right, exactly. Right. So let's say you have one person watching money for two babies. Reuven and Shimon both give a sum of money to the third party. One gives 100, the other one gives 200. So now he's holding on to 300 to be divided among two people, and they both claim that they're the 200 person. So the answer the Gemara gives to that is the Eimunah, that there's no way to resolve it apparently, so it has to wait until Eliyahu comes, which in essence seems to be therefore a bad play on their part because essentially everyone loses. And then it's the machlokas in the Gemara. What we mean by that? Do we mean just that third 100 gets set aside? Or do we mean maybe the whole sum should get set aside? Because otherwise you got nothing to lose. And so you'll just try to claim it. Either you'll get it, or if you're the liar, you'll try to claim it, and either you won't get it or you will get it, but you might as well try. So if at least you're risking your portion, so then there's some kind of disincentive. Jonathan?
So we're saying there's two different ones, a Kol Yemunah versus a Shari Yemunah, or one just the Yemunah?
Well, it's Machlokes the Gemara what Munach means. But Munach itself is one category.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll call Munach one, and then whether Munach means the whole thing is Munach, or just the extra is Munach, is Machlokes. So those are at least three. There are a few others. Anyone want to throw out one or two others?
We have cases where it's chalukah below shemua.
Right, so that could possibly be a different kind of chalukah. We'll have to figure that out. And so we'll have to, when we look, focus, after our introductory phase, we focus on chalukah. We'll have to see what the differences are between the different kinds of chalukah. But yeah, that could certainly be counted as a separate one. It's a legitimate other category. Any other possibilities?
Shuda
the Daini. Shuda the Daini, right? And once again, Shuda the Daini is subject to a machlokas. Almost every one of these is subject to a machlokas. Sometimes the machlokas is relatively minor. Sometimes in the case of Kol Da'alim Gavar, it's so fundamental that it really places things in a different side of the equation. But Shuda the Daini is another major option. Shuda the Daini sounds like this topic of machlokus between the Rashbam and Tosfos, as we'll see, but it's somehow the discretion of the judge. So does it mean an arbitrary discretion, or does it mean that the judge uses what he has at his disposal to try to figure out, but ultimately it's essentially his call? So that's another option, and one that you might not be counting as a separate one, so we'll just help you out, is simply the idea of hamotzi mechaver al varaya, which is brought sometimes as the opposite of sumchus, but the idea of the priority always given to whoever could be categorized as a muchzak when that's relevant, and that's obviously in major issue in our mission as well. So that's going to be a factor also, and I have to see where that plays out and where that is the guiding policy. So we have somewhere between three and six policies, depending on how you want to count them. And we have different scenarios. So we know the Gemara says some cases it's A, some cases it's B, some cases it's Z. And sometimes the Gemara gives us a clue as to why we pick one or the other, and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes the Rishonim, particularly in our case, in our Sugya and Bava Basra, which are very lengthy, so if you take the first two Gemaras from the list this morning, those are really very much connected to each other. So what's the primary conflict the Rishonim want to figure out in that case? Yachloku versus Kol Da'alim Gavar. That's the primary issue with Yehemunach, also part of the discussion, but primarily they want to figure out what exactly. The Gemara gives us some clues, and the Rishonim have to take it a little bit further to try to understand why you would say one, why you would say the other. So what type of, and without trying to sort out which Rishon is saying which, because sometimes that's also a discussion, so we'll give that some focus afterwards. But what are some of the points that are brought? What are some of the criteria that are invoked? And even if you didn't see the Rishon, what are some that you might think of on your own as being relevant? Hi.
Possession.
Possession. Okay, so one of the major issues is possession. Now, possession you could have with a capital P or with a lowercase p, as we'll see, right? And that's something that's going to get a lot of focus. What do I mean by that? By saying there's possession and there's possession. I'm not talking about ghosts, but sorry?
Tfisa?
Tfisa, okay. So what do you mean by tfisa? Tfisa also has different contexts, different usages.
Like if someone grabs it.
I think I was also a cold on guard situation. Sorry, but so tfisa, right. So tfisa sometimes means grabbing. In some contexts in the Gemara, tfisa means that something was open and you took it and now you've changed the playing field a little bit. But tfisa literally means you're holding it, right? So possession, if we're talking about the fact that you are physically holding something, that's one definition of possession. The other hand, Eli, you wanted to comment on that?
Kona.
So, but the question is, do we know who is Kona? Right? That's sometimes part of the issue. That one person will claim to have been Kona something, and others will argue against it. So there is a concept in Halacha, as we'll get some significant exposure to, of being a muchzak, of being somebody who is presumed to be the owner. Now that correlates a lot to physically holding it, but it's not always the exact same thing. So we have to figure out, this is a major issue really in the Rishonim and in those who interpret the Rishonim, that to what extent is that really happening here? So our Mishnah, for example, which says Shnayim Ochsin, so indeed, you're right, a lot of the Rishonim pay a lot of attention to that word, that Ochsin. Not all of them. Right? If you get to see, I don't know if anyone saw Tosfos in Bava Basra, I'll give you a little bit of a preview of it, but hopefully tomorrow I'll get a chance to see Tosfos in Bava Basra, that not all of the Rishonim emphasize this, but certainly a lot of the Rishonim think this is important. The fact that the Mishnah says Ochzim. In fact, one Rishon who you probably did see, I'll give you a hint, if you got anywhere within Rishonim you saw this, who puts a big emphasis on Ochzim?
Rashi.
Right, it's the first word in Rashi, right? The first word in Rashi in the Masechta is Davka Ochzim. Right, we are specifically talking about a case where there is Ochzim, and he goes on to say, Dishnehem Muchzakim Ba. Now, as we'll see, do we mean Muchzakim, lowercase p, that they're holding it, or is there higher case P, uppercase P, that means the classic halachic sense of muchzak? It's not 100% clear. We'll have to figure that out. You know, do we actually give the presumption to whoever is holding it in the full sense of the word? Or is it a weaker type of connection that's derived from the fact that they're holding it? You could also have it the other way around. You'll see, for example, God willing, if you see the Rush, which was on the list also, that the Rush, for one, mentions that the case of Yehei Munach is a case of Muchzak. The case of Manashlishi, where the Gemara says Yehei Munach is Muchzak. How is the Muchzak? Why would you say it's not Muchzak, first of all? Jonathan?
They're not really holding it.
They're not holding it, right? Both parties have given it to somebody else to watch. So they're not physically Machzik, but yet, and this is a debated point, as we'll see, maybe they're still considered to be Muchzak. Maybe they're still considered to be possessing it because they have an agent possessing it on their behalf. We have to figure out what that means. So, possession is a big issue, right? And muchzak is a big issue. Are they the same thing in this case? We'll have to figure that out. The physical possession and the concept of muchzak are major players in this discussion. Are they happening together here? Are they possibly separated from each other? That's something we'll have to see. But definitely there are many Rishonim who are maintaining that that's a big factor here. The factor that in our Mishnah there is a achiza going on, which may or may not equal to muchzak. And in the case of Kol Da'alam Gavar in the Gemara in Bava Basra, by the way, we didn't say what it was. The case in Bava Basra, did anyone see that case, what the Gemara is talking about over there? So I should probably spell it out. Hi, sorry. Right, so that's the primary case. The Gemara has a couple of cases, but the case that the Gemara first mentions, which is one that the Rishonim all bring in, sorry for not clarifying this earlier, is you have a boat, and you have two people who both claim that the boat is theirs. And as Rishonim emphasized, in that case, there's no clear muchzak aspect in any sense of the word. Right, there's no indication that one party has any greater connection to it than the other. And there's no physical holding on to it. There's nothing that we could interpret as ochzen or muchzak in that case. So a lot of the Rishonim, probably the majority of the Rishonim, emphasize that as a major distinction between the two cases. Our Mishnah is talking about ochzen, and Arba, the case of the boat, there is nothing paralleling that. Now, there are other elements as well, which the Gemara also throws in some of the Rishonim focus. What else is possibly relevant to this question, to distinguishing between any cases that we might talk about? Jonathan?
So there's an opinion of it has to be, you can't do a split that will automatically be a lie.
So that's a very major point, and that's something we're also going to have to try to figure out what that phrase means. Right, so there's two sentences which may or may not be the same thing. I'm very not sure they're the same thing. On the one hand, what Jonathan just mentioned, is there is a criteria that some of the Rishonim mentioned, and that the Gemara alludes to, of Chaluka Yechola Lios Emes. Right, that at least conceivably, can get into the odds separately, but at least conceivably, maybe this Chiluk makes sense. Maybe this Chiluk is true. That when we divide it between these two parties, maybe there's truth to it. Does that mean it's likely true? Does that mean that the odds are very high? Not necessarily. But, let's say in the case of our Mishnah, you have two people claiming the same garment because they both claim they found it. So as the Gemara notes, right, it's possible. It's possible they both found it. It's possible they both picked it up at the same time. And therefore, they have equal rights to this object. So, it's conceivable. Now there's another phrase which may or may not be connected to this. What other phrase am I thinking of?
George
Roman is also an important one, right? I want to get to that one separately. That's again a mystery what that means, but that's also that's next on the list. But one that might be identical to this Chalukah Chol Yasemis.
Not just identical, but Baruch Shem maybe.
Baruch Shem is also important. These are all this is also comes in that Baruch Shem we'll have to get to in a whole other separate level. But I'm wondering about the concept of yes, thank you. Who said that? Yes, thank you. Right. So the question of Vadai Ramai, right, which means what? If somebody is for sure lying, now it's always possible somebody's lying, that's why we have to throw in the word vadai. You can never say there's vadai no ramai. But in some cases, the very nature of the case is that one party is lying and one party is not. And sometimes it's not the case. Sometimes there are two people who honestly believe what they're saying, or all the facts are not in dispute. It's just a question of whose facts are stronger. There are all kinds of civil conflicts where it's not premised on one party lying necessarily. As you mentioned, maybe that's the case with the Talis. And again, it doesn't have to be the case, but it's possible that everybody is telling the truth. So if that's the case, so that's one thing. But if there is definitely a Ramai, if the whole scenario is such that you have to assume somebody's lying, so then sometimes the rules shift. Now, is that the same thing as Chaluk V'Yichol Yos Emes? Maybe, maybe not. And it depends on why you're saying it. So we'll have to get into that discussion a little bit to see how they are connected to each other. So and another factor, as you mentioned, Gerard Mamona is another big mystery because Gerard Mamona can go in there in the column with the Kol Da'alam Gavar in the sense of we have no idea what it means, right? As we'll see, we'll have to give that some focus as well, that Rishonim have very different interpretations of just what those words mean. But there's some mysterious factor which shifts the nature of a case. Maybe it means that somebody's losing out, or both parties are losing out, or Tosfos, just to, again, just to give enough of a definition so we could move on, right? So Tosfos says, what does Gerard Mamona mean?
It means actually losing money.
Well, that's how Rashi kind of seems to see it, but Tosfos says... So what Tosfos' point is that there'll be a safek even without them.
Right.
So that we have a situation, we know that there's a mystery here. So then, if Besdin is already involved in this case, even without them coming and saying anything, so that changes the landscape a little bit. So all of these factors, and possibly more, are brought into the discussion. So something we have to think about is, why do we care? So let's say, Cholios Emes, Ramai, Ochsin. Why do we care about any of these things? Why are these factors in our thinking?
There's no other evidence.
We know what?
We have no other evidence of anything.
We have no other evidence, so we're grasping at straws. We're looking for whatever we can to try to tilt the scales. So essentially we're saying it's one thing if we have nothing. Right? So for example, that might lead us to Kol Da'alam Gvar, maybe. And we've got nothing to work with. Or maybe a Shudig Daini situation, depending on how you understand each concept, if we have absolutely nothing. Well, if we have something, maybe we do a little bit more. Maybe. It's one possible issue. What else?
Right. A big part of it is Besdin's trying to find out what the din is, what Emes is. We're not just arbitrarily picking the winner, but Besdin is not just, they're not empowered to make halacha. They have to follow what the halacha is. So if they can't figure it out somehow, if they're going to be saying a wrong din, that's problematic.
Oh, okay. So that... you're touching on a very important question, and that might be really one of the central issues to try to establish in this whole sugya, maybe as part of our basic introduction. That how much is that true? You know, is Besdin essentially tasked with finding the truth? And you might think, what are you talking about? Of course it is. You know, what else is its job? So that's something we're going to have to figure out. We'll have to see how much more time we have today. We're going to have to continue this discussion a little bit into tomorrow. But why might that not be the case? What else could Besdin's job be? To find out false things? I mean, what is, if not to find the truth, what else is its job? Dov?
To make peace.
To make peace. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, that's possibly true, Jonathan.
Maybe it's just simply to figure out, or to designate somebody. Let's say you have a better, you just have a stronger claim. So it's not necessarily that, you know, they're saying with absolute certainty that it's true and that's mm-hmm. the truth, but with the evidence presented before us, your claim is stronger, and we're not necessarily saying that we're, that it's, you know, the truth.
Okay, so that's also a fascinating point. That actually creates maybe three possibilities. And we'll see, once we get into Yachlok in a little bit more detail, that's going to be a major element. We try to figure out what exactly is the nature of Yachlok. So those points are all, Nate, you wanted to comment on that?
I'm just not sure why those two points are mutually exclusive.
They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. Hopefully they work in harmony, but they are different. And possibly what we highlighted here was just three different points, and I'll try to flesh it out a little bit. That you could say that Bezdin's key role is to assign, is to try to identify the actual truth. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that Bezdin are truth investigators everywhere, and that they're going to knock on your door and try to figure out when your son and your daughter are fighting with each other over an ice cream, that they have to get involved in everything? So it doesn't mean that they're going to find that it's their job to ferry out the truth in every single human conflict. But it may mean that when Bezdin is involved, that that's their job. Bezdin doesn't necessarily get brought in, and as we see from our cases here, Bezdin doesn't always agree to get called in. Right? That might be part of the Kol Dolem Gavar question. Right? As you brought out the Bet HaSila for Reb Yehuda, is that maybe Bezdin, that whole question of what the phrase means, goes to the issue of is Bezdin essentially involved or not. Right? So Bezdin doesn't necessarily get involved with everything. But if they're involved, maybe that's their job to try to figure out what is true and what is not true. And that's really what they're tasked with. Alternatively, so to go, let's say, in order, so Jonathan's formulation is a little bit different. His formulation is that they're obligated to paskin when they get involved. And their psak may not necessarily indicate truth, because they may not have access to full truth. So their psak has to be whatever makes the most sense, whatever is the closest to the truth, based on what they know, based on what they have. And what Dov is pointing at is something different, is that maybe that's not even their tafkid either, but maybe their tafkid, they're here to keep the peace. So people who are in conflict have a problem, and Bezdin is here to try to resolve that problem, not necessarily exclusively in terms of figuring out what happened and what didn't happen, who's right and who's wrong, but establishing what needs to be done in order to keep the peace. So I'm going to have to rush through this a little bit because we're almost going to be out of time. It is, in general, considered to be high priority of the yeshiva that we all daven mincha together. So we try to always be at the 2:30 mincha in the base medrash, 2:33 mincha in the base medrash when possible. So we'll have to follow up on this more tomorrow for sure. But that issue is very possibly very much at the heart of some of these questions. What is Bezdin really tasked to do? And that itself, and I'll give you some questions to keep in mind as tomorrow, as you see some of the Rishonim, and you might find the Rishonim perhaps really hitting at this point, if you look carefully enough. What is the ideal? If we have Yachloku and Koldal and Gavar and Shunt the Daini, so what would our preference be if we could? What's the ideal if we could rank them, if they were all equally possible in any case? And we had all 3 to 6 options in front of us. Which would we choose? And to answer that question, you'll have to know a lot more about what the options mean, for sure. But once you even have all the facts, the answer to that question is, what exactly is the role of Bezdin? What would Bezdin ideally want to do? And the truth is, if you saw, I put on the Marmar Komos towards the end, Gemara in Sanhedrin, that highlights the fact that there's not necessarily unanimous agreement as to what the goal of Bezdin is. And the guys from the shul last year know that I get very excited by what we call synergy. And that we like it when the different things that we're talking about happen to come together. So here we are on a Monday immediately following Parsha Shoftim. So if you paid attention, or if you paid very close attention to some of the Shukim, but also some of the Rishonim and the Meforshim and the Kriyas HaTorah this past week, so this is very possibly at the core of this issue. And so we read Shabbos morning, Shoftim v'Shotrim, Titeim l'cha v'chol sh'arecha, and we have an obligation to set up Batei Din. What is the key obligation of a Beis Din? So the Gemara in the beginning of Sanhedrin has a pretty significant machlokus about this. And maybe we'll get into more detail about it tomorrow because it may be important background for understanding some of the ideas. But the Pasuk says, right after telling us Shoftim v'Shotrim, so Rabbi Miller pointed out, our Mashgiach Rabbi Miller, in the Shiurim, he observed that he thought there was a machlokus between the Ramban and the Rambam on this point in the Pasuk of Shoftim v'Shotrim. What is the purpose of Beis Din? If you look at the Ramban, and I put these on the Maamar Komus, if you look at the Ramban, you could argue on this because it takes a kind of a subtle reading of these Rishonim. But if you look at the Ramban says Shoftim v'Shotrim. Why? Because there should be plilim, meaning there should be judges who are there to figure out what the story is when there's a conflict. Judges who can really ascertain the truth. People are going to get into a fight and you need to know what is and what isn't. So you need to have Shoftim v'Shotrim. While if you look at the Rambam's formulation in the Sefer HaMitzvos, so the Rambam, it sounds more, he has a whole listing of things that the Beis Din is there to do, it sounds more like the Beis Din is there to, for the good of society, which includes to keep the peace, to keep people from killing each other. And we know that it's an out-of-context quotation, but it's one that's relevant, that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that we should daven for the government, not just the Beis Din, but the government of any country. Why? Because what happens without the government? Ish Yisrael Chayim Balal, right? That people will eat each other alive. So that phrase is taken out of context a lot in the discussion of the purpose of Beis Din as well, that although some understand especially the mitzvah of Din by Bnei Noach, the mitzvah of Din for all of society, to be connected to that phrase in the Mishnah, that we have to keep people from eating each other alive. We have to have some type of regulation in society, which maybe doesn't necessarily focus on what exactly, who's right and who's wrong, but on keeping people living happily together. So this was a major machlokus in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which maybe you'll see tomorrow, is on the Maamar Komos. The Gemara in Daf Lamed Beis, the Gemara in Daf Vav. So first of all, in Lamed Beis, so the Gemara says, the pasuk that we read Shabbos morning, Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof, right? Very famous pasuk, but seems a little bit redundant, I guess a little bit excessive. Why do we need the word Tzedek twice? So one interpretation the Gemara has is Echad L'Din, V'Echad L'Pshara. What does Pshara mean?
Compromise.
So probably not, that was a trap. Sorry, literally, it's often translated as compromise. We'll discuss tomorrow a little bit more. It was really a shock because most people don't say it that way. But Soloveitchik, as we'll discuss, understood it to mean something much more subtle than compromise. But it's, for now, we can survive that translation, right? That it means definitely something which is different than the letter of the law, so to speak. And the Gemara has a debate over there in Sanhedrin earlier on Dav Vav. The Gemara has a debate. So what is the main goal of Sanhedrin, the main goal of Beis Din? So is it appropriate, they ask the Gemara, mitzvah of Tzoa, do we say that it's appropriate, that it's recommended, that a Beis Din should push for pshara, should deal in pshara? Or the Gemara has an alternate opinion, that kol habotzeya hareza chote, that pshara is an abdication of Beis Din's responsibility. Beis Din is there to figure out the truth. And for them to say, what's trying to make a pshara is them running away from their duty. And maybe it depends, as the Gemara goes into a little bit there, at what stage is this happening? Is this before the discussion? Have they already done all the deliberations? But essentially, the Gemara has these two different views, and the Gemara attributes them to two major figures in our history, Moshe and Aaron. And the Gemara assumes that Moshe's slogan was Yikov HaDin HaSahar, that let the din be so clear and powerful that it could pierce the mountain. While Aaron, what was the slogan of Aaron, as we know from Mishnah Navos? Oev Shalom v'Rodev Shalom. Aaron was less interested, apparently, in who's right and who's wrong, but in getting a harmonious society. And Moshe Rabbeinu more focused on the absolute did.
So there are different attitudes that Gemara itself reflects. Well, halacha, because the Gemara asks, what should the Bezdin be doing? Should the Bezdin be encouraging Pshara or not? And that very much goes to this question, what is Bezdin's primary function? So one of the ideas I'd like you to keep an eye out for tomorrow, as you see some of the Rishonim, is what is considered to be ideal here? What is exactly are we trying to do? We have two people who are in a fight, a conflict. Maybe it's a conflict where we have a little bit of evidence, maybe it's a conflict where we have very little to go on. What would we like to see happen? Would we like to try to push things towards the closest to a true resolution? Or would we like to try to leave two people with some sense of peace? Part of why compromise, even though again it was a total trap, compromise is definitely more common interpretation, but there's a cynical definition of compromise that people have today. They say, what is a compromise? A compromise means both people walk away unhappy. So hopefully that's not what it means in halachic terms, that both people are unhappy. But the goal of Pshara is clearly the opposite, that both people should feel that there is some justice done. But there is a clear difference in attitude. And we'll see, we have to try to understand what Pshara is, because as we get into Yachloku, Pshara is a major, major possible undercurrent in figuring out what Yachloku is. So we'll spend a few minutes tomorrow trying to get a little bit more of an understanding of Pshara. So these are all some guideline questions as you get to the Mar Makomos a little bit more tomorrow morning. Try to pay attention to some of these issues. What is it that might push us towards one of the 3 to 6 policies or the other? Why do we care about those factors? Try to think about those questions. Why do we care, Ikar Rabbi, Chaluku, Yecholios, Emes, etc.? Why do those things make a difference? And what is our preferred system? And just in terms of closing off today's introduction, so in terms of the question we started off with, just to give us a little bit of a davar shalom, so what I hope you see a little bit here is that I think this sugya is so fundamental. Essentially, this is the ABCs of all of Choshen Mishpat, but essentially all of human conflict can be viewed through the prism of the sugya, part of why it's especially exciting as an opening for the Masechta, as an opening for anything in this area. What we're trying to figure out as we get into the bare bones of the sugya is what are the key fundamental principles that we take in terms of addressing human conflict? What are our goals? How do we plan on going about them? What factors do we take into consideration? These are the key elements in terms of how do we address any issue that people have with each other. So that being the case, just to mention the question we started with, I think it makes a lot of sense that this is the first parak of at least this Masechta, if not everything, but that this comes before Elul Metzias. Really the question is, which is a detail of the other? Is this parak a detail of Elul Metzias, or is Elul Metzias a detail of Shnai Mochsen? So the Rishonim who asked the question, they thought that maybe this is a detail of Elul Metzias. First, Elul Metzias, you find some stuff, you're able to keep it sometime. So now we have to figure out, what if two people find it at the same time? But one could argue, I think, it's quite the opposite, that Elul Metzias is really a detail of this parak. This parak is the basic fundamental building blocks of how do we address conflict property that could potentially belong to two people. How do we address that? What kind of things do we take into consideration? And then chapter 2 after this, Elul Metzias will now talk about, okay, lost property, found property, as a detail of the very broad fundamental yesodos that are addressed in this week's parsha. In this opening parsha. So just to quickly review, what did we speak about? So we spoke about the fact that there is a special maila to learning Choshen Mishpat of Banatam L'Chavero, especially during Elul. It's a path to Chasidus, but it's also Mars Chasidus, but it's also a path to understanding the Chachma Sabore in a way that we don't always have that much access to, and that this parak particularly has a special advantage in that sense in its fundamental nature, which may be why we have this parak before Elul Metzias, the question that the Rishonim asked, separate from the question Tosfos asked, why Bava Metzia comes after Bava Kamma. We talked about that a little bit, and we talked about the fact that our
Gemara tells us a policy of Yachloku, which if we only knew the Mishnah, we would have just been able to say, Maman Hamutal Basafek Yachloku, but we see that that's not the whole story. There are many different cases, which give us somewhere between 3 and 6 different policies. Yachloku, Kol Da'olam Gavar, which is a big machlokus what it means, could mean very opposite things. Yehemunach, which is a slight machlokus what it means. Shuta D'Daini, which is an in-between machlokus what it means. Hamotzi Mechavero Olav Haraya, possibly a different version of Yachloku, if you want to say Yachloku without a Shvuah, is a different category. We didn't get into any details of the Shvuah, which we'll say we'll deal with separately. And then we talked about what are some of the reasons why you might say one, you might say the other. So we saw that there is a big emphasis on the Ochsin of the Mishnah, but we're not sure whether that means Muchzakos or not. Is that the same thing as Muchzak? There's all kinds of scenarios that may either separate or connect them. The question of Chalukalios Emes, Vadai Ramai, which may or may not themselves be the same thing, we have to get into that. The question of Drar de Mamona, big mystery what that means, we'll have to get to that separately. Bari Vashema was brought up, we'll have to also see how that fits in. And then we discuss the question of what exactly is our preferred system, which goes to the issue of what exactly is Bezdin meant to do. Is Bezdin meant to figure out the truth? Is Bezdin meant to paskin in whatever way is closest to the truth, even if it's not the truth? Or is Bezdin meant to bring shalom, which is a possibility as well? And the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin has a significant machlokus about this. Do we say that pshara is a goal of Bezdin? It's encouraged. Do we say that pshara is bad? It's an abdication of Bezdin's responsibility. The differences between Moshe and Aaron invoked in that Gemara, all of that's going to play an important role as we try to address some of these issues. Everyone should have a wonderful day. Head towards the Beit Midrash Menucha, and it should be only good things.